Hail to the Thief is the title of Radiohead's fourth album in just a little under 3 years. The much-anticipated Kid A began this sequence and then was followed by Amnesiac and the live recordings on the album I Might Be Wrong. The band were in New York recently around the time of the release of their new album at Electric Lady Studios. They sequestered themselves there for the day, did a whole bunch of press interviews and a couple of live radio sessions. One of them was for KCRW. We also got all five members of the band up into a room above the studio a little bit later on in the afternoon for an interview. We'll get to the interview shortly, but first up, as always, the music. Here's Radiohead on Morning Becomes Eclectic.
1, 2, 3 Job that slowly kills you, bruises that won't heal. You look so tired, happy, bring down the government. Silent
I'm Nick Harcourt, and you're listening to Morning Becomes Eclectic at 89.9 KCRW, and a very special live performance recorded in front of a live audience at Electric Lady Studios in Greenwich Village, New York, with Johnny Greenwood and Tom York of Radiohead. The songs in the first set were I Might Be Wrong, Punch Up at a Wedding, I Will, Sail to the Moon, and No Surprises. I was very fortunate to persuade the whole band, Johnny and Colin Greenwood, Phil Selway, Ed O'Brien, and Tom York, to join me in a small room above the main studio for an interview. It was a rainy New York afternoon, and if you listen carefully, you'll hear the rain in the background as we talked about a number of things, including the new album Hail to the Thief. But we began by discussing the recording of the albums Kid A and Amnesiac, and I asked if at that time they had been pushing themselves to explore the boundaries of what a group of musicians could accomplish within the confines of a band. Here's Tom York.
Someone said that, one of us said this recently, our minds kind of got blown as to the possibilities which we hadn't pursued yet, you know. And so when we started doing Kid A and Amnesia, it was sort of, we were almost frozen up by the fact that we actually could do anything we wanted. We were a band, but yet we were into using samplers and into programming, and we were into basically giving ourselves the freedom to go any way we wanted. And it was kind of actually quite it wasn't like exploring uncharted territory in that sense. It was just like, well, what we've been doing up till now is not turning us on, me especially, anymore. And so you start looking at every other possibility and kind of freak out.
Well, that was after, as you said, all the touring with OK Computer, I guess, right? You just really needed to look at things in a different way?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just the touring on OK Computer. We basically signed at the end of 91, and we pretty much went on the road from about May 92 and didn't stop until, you know, what was it, the summer 98. I mean, I think the beginning of... When we started rehearsing OK Computer, we had a month off, but that's the longest we'd had off. So it wasn't just that, it was the continuation. And we kind of wanted to get to that stage whereby we could go, OK, let's stop. Whoa, we can stop. Mm. And, you know...
I remember the initial stages of OK Computer, when we decided to do Glastonbury and all that. And I remember saying to everybody... not that I hold it against you. But, okay, we'll do Glastonbury and then we'll do a few months, but that's it, I can't do any more, I'll crack up. I just won't be able to do any more, I need to not do this. And a year and a half later, we finally did. And it took me a very, very personally a very, very long time to recover. And that was just all in the music. I think everybody suffered from it to an extent.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
No, we've just by the end of 98, we were vegetables.
Fried, yeah.
We're vegetables.
A little earlier on, with the audience here, you're talking about how the songs can be different from the studio to performing them live. And as we just said, you toured a lot during the last few years, even though you've taken time off in between. It's interesting to think of the songs on the last two studio albums in particular as having been conceived and put together in a room or a studio. How did they change, or how do they change when you perform them live?
What's strange is how each process, recording and performing live, they inform each other, so that when it came to trying to play Kid A and Music live, we had to learn quite new processes of playing. And
but
techniques
was,
of making music.
Was, yeah, but it was surprisingly simpler than we thought it would.
It was. It was much simpler because we were still in that framework work of just letting go and being excited by it all. And then when it came to writing these songs for this record, we could use those techniques without thinking about it. And what had been a bit slow during recording Kid A and Amnesiac just suddenly felt very natural and could just be, you know, grabbed, taken off the shelf and used. Whatever process it was, right. Which is great position to be in.
It also meant that in a way, when we got into like programming or, you know, spending like 2 or 3 days working on sounds before they went down or whatever, towards the end, it wasn't such a big deal. It wasn't. I mean, because it was because everybody now understood the necessary boring bits in the recording. You know what I mean? And it was sort of all right. When you know that, remember the Mixmatosis, when I'd sort of spent more or less 24 hours straight cutting up what you'd done on the drums film, and like the only way to have got it done was just like, okay, leave me alone and I'll try and it was worth doing, but you know, but that wouldn't have happened before when we were doing Kid A and Amnesia, because It was an insecurity thing. People were like, well, why are we spending 2 days doing this? Why are we spending 2 days cutting up drums or programming the, you know, this bit here or this bit there, blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, yeah, whatever, you know, fine. If that's what we need to do, let's do it.
Right.
So it was not just sort of, it informed the live shows, and then, as Johnny said, it then informed how we work in the studio. And speed is being of the essence.
So each process kind of feeds the other one in a certain way.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you're not frozen up by the possibility, or you just like get on with it and try just to kick us up the arse, saying, well, if you want to try that, try it, and you've got 4 hours.
Right.
And if you ain't got it done in 4 hours, then we'll do something else. And that's actually really good.
Yeah, it's all about speeding up the time between what's in your head and what people hear, and so that it becomes hopefully as natural as possible, however much technology you use.
Well, you're talking about Nigel Godrich, obviously, who's produced the last 4 albums, I guess, now. And you did this one in L.A.
Yeah.
Why come to L.A.? It surprised me for some reason. Well, I don't know. You know, I think of Radiohead as not an L.A. band. But
I didn't mean it rudely. I mean, sort of, you know, why go to L.A.?
Why indeed?
We want to end up playing, you know, the Viper Room with a few ex-punks.
Yeah. Well, I know that Nigel uses a studio there in particular quite a lot.
I think that's the main reason.
Is that it?
Yeah.
And we wanted to have a place where we did like an initial thing and we get away from everything else and you just lock yourself in a room. It was a little bit of like, yeah, just that we'd never dream of doing that. At all.
And a lot of studios you go to, things can just feel quite pretentious, I suppose, portentous. And LA never does, really, which is quite a nice thing about it.
I mean, did it influence any way that the songs came out, do you think, spending that time there as opposed to, you know, the English countryside?
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that when we went back and had the autumn back in Oxfordshire, we did 2 weeks in LA and 5 weeks in Oxfordshire, the songs changed quite a bit. You know, I think the songs were really, really, really warm. They're really warm. And we sort of, you know,
I think we were pretty, I mean, it got a bit sticky towards the end of the 2 weeks when we were tired, but I think we were pretty lightened up about being away and just sort of concentrating and...
I mean, that's all you're there for, isn't it, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, we had two evenings off, and, and we managed to get out on that Sunday and go to the desert, and that was it. And we just worked solidly, but it was fun, because we'd been waiting to do it for ages, you know what I mean? And it wasn't Britain.
Because of the album's title, a lot of people are saying, oh, it's a political record, etc., etc., and I know that you've been quoted in saying that it's not. But I read in a recent interview you gave to Spin magazine where you, Tom, said that while you were making the record, you became, and this is a quote, obsessed with how certain people are able to inflict incredible pain on others while they believe they're doing the right thing.
Hmm. Yeah, because a lot of the record is about that, the frustration and powerlessness and anger and the huge gap between the people that anoint themselves and put themselves in control and the people that allegedly voted for them. I mean, that was something I really couldn't get away from on the record. It was really apparent all the time.
I know that a couple of you are dads. I know that you became a dad a couple of years ago. Who else is a dad?
Yeah, I am.
I became a dad myself 3 months ago. And what a perspective shift I experienced just in this brief period of time. How does that life experience impact the way you write?
Talking about writing, I'm looking at you, Tom.
No, I was just thinking, I mean, you know, the lack of time is the obvious one. when you go and you work quickly. And becoming a dad makes you think about what it is that you do yourself. And personally speaking, it made me consider that music is a gift rather than something to be frustrated about and angry over. But the other side of the coin is that I think one of the most important things on this record, although I don't think I thought about it at the time particularly, or maybe I did, was that feeling of anger and frustration at being totally powerless to change the future that awaits our children. I think that you'd not be human if you didn't feel like that. And I think this record, from the title to the music to the lyrics and everything, is that, really. It's the core of the record. It's like, how dare you destroy our children's future, you motherfuckers.
Ed, you said in a recent interview that Hail to the Thief represents the end of an era. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it just, there's something about the way that we've recorded this, we've made this record, that it may be to do, when I said that, maybe to do with the fact that it's the first time the recording session has been really easy. And it feels like we've employed ways that we've made this record in a way that has drawn upon things, particularly because of the live thing, but drawn upon things of over the last five records. And, you know, we've kind of, Nigel said, he said at one stage, and say, this is the album that you've deserved to make. And okay, we've kind of done this now. So, you know, personally speaking, it feels like we really, really need to sort of go away and do something completely, completely different.
You're right. It's also, I think, I mean, it has set a lot of ghosts.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I think things that have been lurking there from as far back as Pablo Honey.
Yeah.
You know, actually managing to get through those anxieties when you're in the studio and do that. It's just like, okay, right, that is behind us.
Yeah.
Now, so.
We haven't talked about it, but we haven't even talked. I mean, I feel vaguely embarrassed saying that it feels like an end of an era, but it really, really does. So, you know, it kind of like.
It's time to really change because
it's, you know, what you do is, well, what we've been doing is also a young person's game, right. You know, it really is.
We're old gits now.
Everyone's and getting older.
If you want to carry on doing it, you have to change the way that you know, and the music has to follow suit, maybe. We
have to get like mid-tempo.
We've been doing that all our lives.
Really? We're getting faster.
We're actually getting faster.
We're getting
it's where it's, yeah. It's midlife crisis, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
No, I can do this still.
Really?
I just got to not get wasted the night before. That's the key.
Well, thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it. Radiohead on One It Becomes Eclectic. We're going to go back to another set of music right now from Tom and Johnny. And thank you.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, Nick.
Thanks a lot.
what you'll get. This is what you'll get. This is what you'll get when you mess with us. Thank you.
Plastic watering can for a fake Chinese rubber plant and a fake plastic earth that you bought from a rubber man. Town full of rubber plants to get rid of itself. It was around. It was around. It was around. She lives with a broken man, a crackpot of styrene. Just crumbles and burns. I used to do surgery for girls in the
You've been listening to a live performance by Tom York and Johnny Greenwood of the band Radiohead. The songs in the second set were Go to Sleep, Karma Police, Everything in Its Right Place, Fake Plastic Trees, and There There. The performance was recorded for KCRW listeners in front of a live audience at Electric Lady Studios in New York and was recorded by Nigel Godrich, the band's longtime studio producer. Special thanks to Chris Hufford, Steve Nice, Rob Gordon, and Ted Volk. Thanks to Bob Carlson at KCRW for editing. I'm Nick Harcourt.